The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is one of the youngest labor leaders in American history, Amy Dean, author of the cutting-edge book, A New, New Deal, a dynamic new approach to organized labor for the 21st century. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's officially summer this week. Not that we had any doubt about it here in the Sonoran Desert where I live, since the thermometer has been registering 100 degrees for some time now. Still, summer's a time for vacations, and of course, vacations means vacation photographs. Which brings up a story about cameras that's very well worth telling. I recently bought a new camera, which has a terrific lens on it, just to take those vacation photographs. Camera's a Panasonic. It takes the sharpest, clearest picture of any camera I've ever had the privilege of using. And that's probably because the lens is made by a famous German photographic company called Leica. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. If you were raised as I was, at some point you avoided buying German products of any kind, because many of the same companies that market products today worked closely with the Nazis. In fact, some of the companies that actually built concentration camps and employed Jewish slave laborers during the Holocaust are still around, selling stuff all around the world and here in America. And although the feeling has diminished over the decades, there's still a sense among some Jews to this day, 65 years after the end of World War II, that companies like Krupps or BMW or Mercedes that manufactured the machines that helped Germany fight the Allies and murder 6 million Jews shouldn't benefit from our hard-earned dollars. In truth, even American companies like IBM that helped the Nazi regime have experienced negative fallout in recent years when that history has been uncovered. Well, Leica should be an exception to this anti-German product sensibility, and let me explain why. There's a story behind that. It came to light about 3 years ago, thanks to the detective work of a British rabbi named Frank Dabba Smith, and it's a story worth retelling. Leica, you may know, was the pioneer 35mm camera. Leica was a very German product always, precise, minimalist, utterly efficient. Behind its worldwide acceptance as a creative tool was a family-owned, socially-oriented film called E. Leitz, Inc. Ernst Leitz II was the steely-eyed Protestant patriarch who headed the closely held firm when the Holocaust loomed across Europe. As soon as Adolf Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany in 1933, Ernst Leitz II began receiving frantic calls from Jewish associates, asking for his help in getting them and their families out of the country. As Christians, Leitz and his family were immune from Nazi Germany's Nuremberg laws, but the Jews were not. To help his Jewish workers and colleagues, Leitz quietly established what has become known as the Leica Freedom Train, a covert means of allowing Jews to leave Germany in the guise of Leitz employees who were being assigned overseas. And so, employees, retailers, family members, even friends of family members were assigned to Leitz's sales offices in France or Hong Kong, in Britain or the United States. Leitz's activities intensified after Kristallnacht in November of 1938, during which synagogues and Jewish shops were burned and Jews murdered all across Germany. Before long, Light's German employees were disembarking from the ocean liner Bremen at a New York pier and making their way to the Manhattan office of Light's Inc., where executives quickly found them jobs in the photographic industry. Each new arrival had around his or her neck the symbol of freedom, a new Leica camera. The refugees were paid a stipend until they could find work. Out of this Light's migration came designers, repair technicians, salespeople, marketers, and writers for the photographic press. The Leica Freedom Train was at its height in 1938 and early 1939, delivering groups of refugees to New York every few weeks just when nobody else would take them. And then, with the invasion of Poland on September 1, 1939, and the explosion of World War II, Germany closed its borders completely. But by that time, hundreds of endangered Jews had escaped to America, thanks to Leitz's efforts. How did Ernst Leitz II and his staff get away with doing it? Well, Leitz Inc. was an internationally recognized brand, a top one that brought credit to the newly resurgent Third Reich. And it was also part of an essential industry. The Leitz company produced Leica rangefinders and other optical systems for the German military. And the Nazi government desperately needed hard currency from abroad. Leitz's single biggest market for optical goods was the United States, and we paid, in those days at least, in cash. Well, even so, members of the Leitz family and the firm suffered for their work. A top executive of Leitz, Alfred Turk, was jailed for working to help Jews and freed only after the payment of a huge bribe. Leitz's own daughter, Elsie Kuhn Leitz, was imprisoned by the Gestapo after she was caught at the border, helping Jewish women escape into Switzerland. She eventually was freed but endured rough treatment at the hands of the Gestapo, no surprise. She later fell under suspicion when she tried to improve the living conditions of Ukrainian slave laborers, all of them women, who had been assigned to work in the Leitz plant during the 1940s. After the war, Kuhn Leitz received numerous honors for her humanitarian efforts, among them the Officier d'Honneur de Palme Académique from France in 1965 and the Aristide Briand Medal from the European Academy in the 70s. But the Leitz Freedom Train was not known because Ernst Leitz II did not want public credit for what he had done. Why didn't anybody tell his story? Because the family refused publicity for its heroic efforts. Only after the last member of the Leitz family died was the Leica Freedom Train finally allowed to come to light. So, purchase Leica products with pride. For Ernst Leitz and his family acted with uncommon grace, generosity, and modesty, and chose to save Jews when other German companies were helping to kill them. Quite a story, and a good way to start our show this morning. To play our show in this morning, here's a Shir Ladonai, a song to God from the Friday night Kabbalat Shabbat service and the Shabbat Extravaganza Band.
Shiru Ladonai, Shiru Shir Hadash, Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Shiru Shir Hadash, Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Borechu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato, Shiru Ladonai, Borechu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato, Shiru Ladonai, Shiru Shechadash, Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Shiru Shechadash, Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Borechu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato, Shiru Ladonai, Borechu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato. Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Shiru Shechadash, Shiru Ladonai, Kol Haaretz, Shiru Ladonai, Baruch Hu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato, Shiru Ladonai, Baruch Hu Shemo, Basru Miyom Liyom Yeshuato.
Shiro Ladonai from the Shabbat Extravaganza Band. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, our guest will be Amy Dean, one of the most interesting and youngest American labor leaders ever, and author of a book that promises the labor movement can and will come back and transform America. Find out how when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish This Morning Amy Dean. She's an author and social entrepreneur who offers solutions, perhaps concrete solutions, to building power for working people. She has a new book out, A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. The book A New New Deal offers a contemporary guide to grassroots activism. She served as the youngest and first female president of the 15th largest regional labor federation in the country, the AFL-CIO in South Bay, led over 90 unions and 110,000 members in the heart of Silicon Valley from 93 to 2001 in an attempt to bring the labor movement back to life. She has been profiled in a wide variety of publications. Good morning, Amy.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, the perception, I think, in this country is that the power of organized labor has been in kind of a steady decline for decades. First of all, is that true? And second of all, is that kind of the result of its own success?
Well, it's clear that there have been several decades of legislative attacks from Republican administrations on the institution of organized labor that have really led to its setback. There have just been a whole range of things that have taken place through what is called the National Labor Relations Board, which is the main body of law that regulates the behavior between employees and employers.
Right, the NLRB, of course.
The NLRB. And that has been an institution that went from being a successful arbiter of labor management conflict to one that pretty much doesn't work at all. So employee-employer relationships have really been at a standstill and have not moved forward as a consequence. Organized labor has not been as effective as it has been historically.
Now, you know, from a Jewish perspective, my grandparents were arbitering labor Zionists. The labor movement is sort of at the heart of so many Eastern European Jewish background, but not too many of us still belong to AFL-CIO unions.
It's true that the Jewish community played an enormous role in the formative stages of the American labor movement, and that many of the immigrant associations or mutual aid associations like the Arbiter's Ring that you referred to, as well as others, served as sort of the precursor to today's trade unions. But the fact is that unions have not made the same inroads in the professional classes, which is certainly where most Jews have migrated to over the last decades.
You have a reputation for having kind of renewed the labor movement in Silicon Valley, which certainly didn't have a reputation as being a, you know, kind of fertile ground for labor unionizing. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I think the case that we made and the work that we continue to do is really twofold. First and foremost, we worked very hard to expand labor's role to be much more than simply a workplace-based organization, but to be a community-based one as much as it was a one in the workplace. In other words, every day of the week, there are numerous decisions that are made regionally by local government, county government, and regional organizations that decide how land use will be used, what transportation systems will be created, what kind of housing will be developed, and all those decisions have enormous impact on the lives of working people and their communities. And so we worked very hard to expand labor's role to go well beyond simply a collective bargaining interest, but to really weave itself into the civic fabric of Silicon Valley, advocating on behalf of all working people. And that was something at the time in the early 90s was really taking a page from labor's past and reinventing that to be part of its future. The second thing that we called for and attempted to work toward was the shift in labor representing people not so much based on the old model of industrial unions where people work for the same employer over their lifetime, but instead moved from employer to employer, and we did a fair amount of experimenting, but certainly never brought anything to scale in experimenting with different kinds of models of representation where unions would, in fact, represent people over multiple employers over their lifetime. So, for example, if you look at the entertainment unions, you look at the building trades unions, these unions are organized much more around occupation, and they recognize that employees travel from employer to employer and are much more beholden to the occupation than to the workplace. And so this is really the way in which unions have to change, and nowhere is there a greater demand than in the heart of America's new economy, Silicon Valley.
We will talk much more with Amy Dean about how the labor movement continues to try to re-energize and recreate itself in the 21st century when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetch or a Kvel, email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts or, of course, at the website. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, our Mavinta, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You just came back from Guatemala a little while ago.
Sí.
Claro que sí, muy bien. And you, you had a great Shabbat experience.
I did, and I'm happy to share this because it was such a profound experience. We were, my husband and I and my daughter were in a tiny little town called San Marcos on Lake Atitlan, which is the largest lake in Guatemala and in Central America. And the place, the little town we were in, was filled with about maybe 2,000 people. Most of them were either expats or people traveling who had fallen in love with Guatemala and wanted to stay there. And they were studying, many of them were studying at this particular town, yoga and meditation and Kabbalah, not Jewish Kabbalah, but the sort of, I think, New Age Kabbalah stuff.
The denatured Kabbalah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But what was so interesting was there were many, many young kids there. And my husband and I, being probably the very older end of the spectrum, went to this restaurant on a Friday evening, a little outdoor restaurant, where I had brought with me two candles, because I said to Lauren, I'm not traveling all the way across the world to see you and not making Shabbat. So I brought these two candles, and my husband and I sat down, and we were going, we had little aluminum foil to put the candles on, and we were going to just, it was very informal, right near the beach, light the candles and give her a blessing. And an Israeli woman that she had, my daughter had befriended, came over and said, oh, Mikabel Shabbat, Gam Kain? She wanted to have Shabbat too. So we said, of course, come sit down. So I start to light the candles, and it was like a moth being drawn to a flame. Within, before I had even finished lighting the second candle, we had about 10 people surrounding our table, all young people. There were three Australians who had worked on a kibbutz in Israel. There was a gal from the Bronx who had ended up studying some kind of philosophy on the island where we were staying. There were my husband, my wife, my husband, my family, and this Israeli gal. And then there was a German, and there was somebody who had traveled from China. And they all came together as we lit these candles. And it didn't matter that some of them had never seen Shabbat. What they understood was that it was this time to come together to bless the family, to be just hold a sacred moment in nature. And it was this incredible experience, because even people who didn't know the blessings kind of closed their eyes, and they swayed, and they hugged when we said Shabbat Shalom, may the Sabbath peace be with you. And then my husband and I turned to give our daughter a blessing that we've been giving her, you know, since she was little. And it was like an automatic, if I had said, I'm giving out free $100 bills, I couldn't have gotten people to line up quicker. The young people kind of lined up, like they all wanted, to be a part of this moment, and they wanted to have maybe an older person or someone that, you know, reminded them of a mom or a dad, just bless them. And so we ended up hugging and giving sort of very, you know, personal kind of sweet little blessings to all these newfound friends. And it was truly, I mean, an amazing Shabbat experience. And what it really showed me was the comfort, the strength, the magic, and I mean magic in the truest form of how magical a moment it can be when you have a beautiful tradition that you've, you know, brought into your family or your home, and you take it out into the world. And so I just really wanted to give that image to your listeners, because I think that, you know, sometimes we're a little reluctant to share some of our traditions, but I think it offers a wonderful opportunity to bring people in to what's so important to us.
What a lovely vignette, and what a lovely way to think about what we really consider the most ethical day, in a sense, Shabbat.
Yes.
Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wadler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos is the finest restaurant in the Southwest. J-Bar are the most fun in all of the Southwest, I'd say, but they're also great places to hear music in the summer.
I think that's one of the things that makes J-Bar and Janos so fun in the summer is the Summer Music Series. We have music every Wednesday and Thursday night out under the stars, and it's a really busy time, a really fun time for us, and great musicians, local musicians, but local musicians who also tour all around the world, and we get them at J-Bar.
You can sit outside, look at the stars, eat great food, have a drink, and just enjoy the summer with the Summer Music Series at Janos and the J-Bar.
And I'll see you there, Rabbi. Give us a call, 615-6100, and we'll have your table ready for you out under the stars, listening to the music.
And eating and drinking. What's the website?
www.janos.com. The full summer music schedule's on the web.
JNOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you just come back from Germany, really the Rhineland, both the German and French sides. That is an unbelievable Jewish area, historically speaking, although not many Jews there now.
Right. I was always aware, sort of theoretically, of the importance of this region to Jewish history, but practically I was stunned on this trip. I was in Alsace, which has bounced back and forth between Germany and France for 1,000 years. And really, this region, besides being a real bedrock of Jewish history in Europe and the center of what we call Ashkenaz, it's also the backbone of the European Union in the sense that Charles de Gaulle and Konrad Adenauer decided in the 50s to bury the hatchet between France and Germany and to create a friendly relationship to replace 1,000 years of warfare. And what's interesting is, I mean, psychologically, and this has little, if anything, to do with the Jewish history of the region, but it's still important to understand, the most bitter rivalries are always between siblings. And the Germans and French in that region both claim to be the descendants of the Franks and the Frankish kings and Charlemagne. And it's not clear whether the Franks ultimately became the French or the Germans or a little bit of both, because the Frankish kingdoms were in this region that kind of straddles the Rhine, which is full of names of towns that are Jewish family names, like Landau and Pforzheim and, you know, just dozens. And as you drive along and you see these exits from the highways, you're struck by this is like a who's who of the Jewish world, because so many American Jews trace their roots to these places. Now, on the French side, except for the bigger cities like Strasbourg and Colmar and cities with 50,000 or more, you have little villages that basically produce wines, and they're great wines, and the villages today have 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people. But even in these tiny, tiny villages, there's always a Judengasse where Jews once lived. There's always remnants of a Jewish community, like a Jewish synagogue or whatever, sometimes intact, sometimes serving as a museum, sometimes being used for other things like a cultural center or a community center, not for the Jewish community because that's no longer existent, but for an evening of culture or whatever. And there's appropriate plaques and due respects paid on the French side of the border. On the German side of the border, it's a little bit different because some of the Jewish communities were so important and so sizable. And I want to talk with you next week specifically about Cologne, which was once the home of a hugely important Jewish community and where there's an awful lot to visit even today.
We will talk next week. Thanks for that great beginning on the Rhineland Jewish community.
I look forward to that.
Now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Morris and Becky are chatting one evening. Morris says, "Becky, it's our 50th wedding anniversary soon, so tell me, have you ever been unfaithful to me?" Becky hesitates for a long moment and then says, "Yes, darling, 3 times. 3 times? How did this happen?" Morris asks her. "Well, Morris, you remember you lost your job a year after we got married. We had no money. We thought we would have to sell the house. And do you remember I went to see the banker to ask for a loan and we got our loan? That's when it happened." "Hard to accept," Morris says, "but since you did this for us and so long ago, I can forgive you. When was the second time?" Becky says, "Well, Morris, do you remember years later when you almost died from your heart problem because we couldn't afford the operation? I immediately went to see the surgeon at his house, and he did your operation for nothing. Well, that's when it happened." "Yes," Morris says, that shocks me, but since you did it because you love me and to save me, I forgive you. But tell me, Becky, what was the third time?" And Becky answers, "Do you remember, Morris, when you were trying to get elected president of the temple and you needed just 12 more votes? Yes, that was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. This story was collected by Rabbi Ed Feinstein, who was actually a storyteller at the school I went to when I was just a child in Dallas. And though it's not about a clever rabbi, it is about a rather clever king. So once upon a time, there was this very powerful and rich king who had this gorgeous palace built in his honor and in the honor of his land. And he had hired all the best craftsmen and artists and artisans to just decorate the most lovely things in his palace. Until finally there was this one long room left bare. And he knew that he had to have something really, really, really special in that room. And so he had a competition. And artists submitted proposals about what they would propose to paint on that one, those long walls. And finally there were two artists that the guy just could not choose between. And so the king offered each of them the same competition. He said, you will both have a year to work in this room, each of you working on the opposite wall from the other. And at the end of the year, whoever has done the best will get the best reward. Well, the two artists, they immediately went to work. Well, at least one of them did. He started sketching out his plans. He started sketching them on the wall. He had people working for him. He had all of the paints, everything that he needed, the king supplied. While the second artist just sat there staring at his blank wall, sometimes not even showing up. And the days passed, and the weeks passed, and the months passed, and the first artist, well, he had produced this masterpiece across the wall. It was clearly shaping up to be one of the most spectacular things that, never mind, he had ever painted, that had ever been painted in this kingdom. And the other artist had done nothing. The wall was left completely blank up until the very night before the competition was to end, when the year was up. And the first artist, well, that night he signed his name, and he had everyone helping him sign their names as well, and looked up at this unbelievable masterpiece and looked over to that wall where there was still nothing on it. Well, shrugging his shoulders, he left for the night, the next day agreeing with the king to meet at a certain time outside of that room. And so they did. The king was there, both artists were there, and as they stepped into the room, the king gasped with surprise. On the one wall, one of the most beautiful pieces of art that he had ever seen, that he felt proud to have commissioned, to have helped bring into the world. And then, on the other wall, the exact same piece of art. And he couldn't understand it, nor could the artist, when suddenly the first artist realized that, that piece of art was the exact same, except there he was, and there the king was embedded in it. And he walked over, and he felt the other artist that night had installed mirrors right across the wall, reflecting his masterpiece. And when the king realized what it was, he said, "Very good job, you two, and I will bring the reward." And he took this big bag of gold and he plonked it down on the ground and he said to the first artist, "This is for you." And the second artist looked and said, "And for me?" And the king said, "You see that bag of gold reflected in your mirrors? That's for you. Get out of my kingdom." The end.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It is named after a man called Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation is familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people have begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the very authority of Moses publicly, taking a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to this story than meets the eye. For Pinchas' reward for killing the couple is a brit shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or to carry a spear. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, and of purification and sacrifice, and he can never engage in any more acts of violence. He has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. For Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades or Jihad or the Inquisition or any kind of religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is not designed to lead towards violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace, that God places on Pinchas. So may it always be. This Torah portion of Pinchas also includes rituals for each of the many festivals of the Jewish calendar. It explores the holidays and their structured cycle of celebrations that adorn the Jewish year, how time itself can be made holy, how the rhythm of life itself is made sacred. That's how we do religion. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk with Amy Dean, a star young labor leader in Silicon Valley who now has a plan to revitalize the American labor movement. Find out what it is when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Israel's security cabinet voted to ease the blockade on the Gaza Strip. While they decided not to remove the naval blockade, Israel will ease land-based imports to Gaza. Until now, only items from a pre-approved Israeli list were allowed in. Going forward, only specific items will be forbidden, such as those that can be used to produce, weapons. In a White House statement, the U.S. welcomed the new policy towards Gaza in response to the many calls in the international community. Once implemented, we believe these arrangements should significantly improve conditions for Palestinians in Gaza while preventing the entry of weapons, the statement said. The White House also said, we strongly reaffirm Israel's right to self-defense and our commitment to work with Israel and our international partners to prevent the illicit trafficking of arms and ammunition into Gaza. As we approach the fourth anniversary of the capture of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, we call again for his immediate release and condemn the inhumane conditions of his detention. There's more follow-up tsoras from the so-called flotilla incident. It continues to flow in. Hundreds of protesters gathered at the port of Oakland, California, to prevent an Israeli cargo ship from unloading. 500 people gathered there at 5:30 a.m. last Sunday to meet the Zim Shipping Line's cargo ship. They talked dock workers into agreeing not to unload the ship when it arrived. The protest was launched in reaction to Israel's interception on May 31st of a Gaza-bound flotilla in international waters off Gaza's coast. 9 passengers were killed, passengers that is armed passengers, during violence that ensued when Israeli naval commandos boarded one of the boats. Protesters in Oakland marched to the port waving Palestinian and Turkish flags while calling to free Palestine, whatever that is. They also called for a boycott of Israeli goods and the rescinding of American aid to Israel. There will be more flotillas to come, aimed from Lebanon or Turkey or you never know where. Israel has to come up with an effective way of interdicting them. And pretty soon you will not be able to get fresh kosher chicken soup in New Zealand. A New Zealand government minister apologized for offending the Jewish community over his comments about deciding to ban shechita, the kosher slaughter of animals, but that didn't change the decision. New Zealand Jewish Council President Stephen Goodman said that he had received an apology from New Zealand Agriculture Minister David Carter for any offense caused by remarks he made last week in relation to his decision to outlaw shechita. Carter said in a June 14th speech to the Association of Rural Veterinary Practices, "We may have upset a relatively small religious minority, and I do appreciate their strong feelings for this issue, but frankly, I don't think any animal should suffer in the slaughter process." Goodman added that he met with New Zealand Prime Minister John Key, whose mother, by the way, Ruth Lazar, escaped Austria on the eve of the Holocaust as a Jew, to express the Jewish community's concerns. "He was very well informed on the issue," Goodman said to the Prime Minister. "We are working on what is the appropriate course of action." The National Animal Welfare Advisory Committee in New Zealand recommended an exemption for shechita be made to the new code, but Carter overruled it, saying there are no exceptions. Now, all commercially killed animals have to be stunned before slaughter. This is illegal in Jewish law. However, it's supposed to ensure that the animals are treated humanely and in accordance with good practice and scientific knowledge. New Zealand's Jews can import kosher meat from Australia, but chickens, kosher or not, cannot be imported into the country according to law. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest this morning, Amy Dean. She's the author of a new book, newish book, A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. An important and innovative figure in the labor movement. She left full-time labor organizing to have, kind of a connection with her family and to re-seek her Jewish roots, but certainly hasn't left the ideology or the approach. Tell us a little bit about that transition in your life.
Well, I think like many parents, we're confronted between seeking qualitative family environment. We want to model for our children the values that we so much believe in, and yet we work so hard that it makes it very difficult to sometimes model for our children our most deeply held aspirations. And so for me, after my first son was born, as much as my passion and commitment was to making change and working on behalf of working people, it was clear that it would not be able to be a lifelong pursuit so long as I was also committed to raising young children. And so when I left the labor movement in 2003, it was with sadness for leaving it behind, but I also knew that at some point I would return, but I still have young children. And I think that's a tension and a conflict that many of us grapple with, and the notion that somehow we can have it all at the same time might not be likely, but if we're committed to saying we can have it all over the span of one's lifetime, that may be a more achievable goal.
I want to come back to talking about the ideas that you have for kind of reinvigorating the labor movement. In addition to what we spoke about earlier in the show about the need for sort of a professionalization of certain unions, so that if you're a high-tech worker, even if you move from, Apple to Intel or whatever, you remain within the same framework. That's really sort of an original labor idea. It goes back to Samuel Gompers, that we're supposed to be skilled trade workers. What do we have to offer people who are in deliberately non-union places, large employers? Walmart comes to mind, places like that.
Well, I think the situation of Walmart is a separate and distinct issue from the one of the reinvention of occupation or craft-based unions. Before the rise of the industrial union and big industries like UAW and U.S. Steel, where all the functions of a firm were housed under one roof, and we had big national industries, we really did have a model of work being performed based on craft or occupation. And I think the future or next generation of trade unions will look something like a hybrid between yesterday's old craft unions and the professional associations that we see today, where people organize themselves based on professional identity. And so I think the next generation will look at like a sort of a hybrid approach between craft unions and professional associations. In order for that to become possible wholesale for the majority of occupations that exist today, we need massive changes in today's labor laws. And while the current debate around labor laws is focused on enabling employees to join unions, it's not focused on changing the structure of who's allowed to join or not join unions. You have to remember that in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was formed, a majority of the ways in which people work and the kinds of occupations that they work in today weren't even invented in 1935. So in order to make this country again be one that looks more like the fat man at the circus with a big bulging middle, instead of what it looks like today, which is the hourglass economy that we confront, where we have jobs at the top, shrinking number of jobs at the top, huge proliferation of low-wage service sector jobs, and very little in the middle. If we want to get back to those days of the fat man at the circus, then we need substantial change in America's labor laws. And that's simply, unfortunately, at this moment, not a debate or discussion that is on the national agenda.
How do we get it onto the agenda? I never, by the way, that fat man at the circus, you know, I never thought about that as a desirable concept, but boy, it really grabs things visually. How do we do that?
Well, certainly we need to once again have the labor movement make alignment and make common cause with so many progressive forces that there are in the community. And one that is an important alliance is the Jewish community. And I've always felt that the relationship between labor and the Jewish community has been one of mutual benefit, but one that can no longer be taken for granted. But clearly, we need to get back to being an America where people aren't just simply struggling to get by, but they're working to make a living. And I think increasingly, even within a prosperous Jewish community, my son goes to a Jewish day school where families are certainly well off if they can afford private tuition for their children. But increasingly, even in this environment, we see so many people struggling to just get by and trading off quality of life with their families as opposed to working and to make a living. And so I think as we continue to see the economy move downward, even those of us who are technically under all terms and conditions being successful, even we are not successful given that we have to make huge trade-offs to our families. And so increasingly, I think this conversation, as things get worse, will become one that is not simply seen as a conversation for low-income employees, but for all of us who are really struggling to get by. There are very few people making it in America and are living with comfort and not terrified looking behind to see where the next paycheck's going to come from or whether we're not going to be able to pay our children's tuition for the next semester.
Let alone pay to send them to college. In Jewish tradition, there's a strong, I say particularly in the book of Deuteronomy, a strong bias towards the working person. Did any of that influence you in going into labor work?
My commitment to the labor movement in particular and to social justice at large is a direct outgrowth of my Jewish values. And it wasn't until much later in my life when I became an alum of the Wexner,
Heritage Foundation,
that I began to understand the textual, historical, and philosophical basis for those yearnings in my heart. And I think many Jewish people have those yearnings. If you talk to people, they tend to define their Judaism in terms of often, not always, but often in terms of secular humanism. That seems to be the thing that is the most common denominator. We see the Reform movement growing in America, and a large part is out of people's desire to see social movement Judaism as a part of their lives. But it isn't until we search for, like I said, the textual basis, the philosophical, historical basis, that we're able to root it. And for me, as a young person growing up in preparation to be a Jewish parent, it was very clear to me that if I wanted to transfer those values to my children, I needed to understand more than just have a warm feeling in my belly to really be able to transfer those values. And so the Wexner Heritage Foundation was so transformational in my Jewish identity in that it gave me those intellectual underpinnings for what was already in my heart.
You know, the New York Times once called you the Christopher Columbus of the American labor movement.
Well, I'm not certain that I was excited about the analogy, but the bigger point to trying to carve new turf or part new waters on behalf of an old institution.
I was thinking maybe the Moses of the American labor movement. He parted waters pretty effectively, no?
Well, they didn't use that analogy.
No, not quite.
In your new book, the New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement, what do you mean by regional activism?
Well, I think that in spite of the fact that we all live in a global economy where capital roams freely, unfettered, unrestricted for the most part, you still see economies organizing themselves, industries organizing themselves on a regional basis. And what constitutes region and what does that mean? Well, it means that economic forces tend to organize themselves and form relationships across industry on the basis of something larger than a city, bigger than a county, sometimes multiple counties at a time, where you have industries and their partners, industry clusters, organized in ways where you have economic boundaries that don't coextend with political ones. So, for example, transportation systems. Transportation systems are very important, and whether they work or don't or serve the right kinds of people or not, to high-tech companies that look for places around the world to launch themselves or to root themselves. Higher education systems become very important. Access to land use policy and to water tables and to first-class airports, all those kinds of things are important to companies that we all compete for that can technically move anywhere around the world. Access to knowledge workers who technically can move anywhere within the U.S. To go to work. But seek quality of work-life issues as they root themselves and their families. All these kinds of issues that are important are not decided city by city or county by county for the most part. So many of the political issues that are important to industry and then ultimately to community don't coextend with the political decision-making structures that we have. And so the need to be able to create civic organization that's organized regionally becomes important, so that working people, industry, and a broad cross-section of civic society can advocate for the kinds of things that are important for industry to be successful, even in a global economy. And so economic boundaries tend to organize regionally, and then as a consequence, so too should people-based organizations.
I want to thank Amy Dean for a great and highly informative visit here on Too Jewish about labor and the new world for labor in the coming years. Her book is called A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement, from Cornell Press. You can find it, the same place you find all your books online. What's your website, Amy?
It is amybdean.com. It's A-M-Y, B as in boy, Dean as in D-E-A-N, D as in David, amybdean.com.
A great blog there and a tremendous amount of information. Thanks very much, Amy.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Mark Gopin, the director of the Center on Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution, who has a very different way to solve the world's problems, probably a better one. Our playout this morning comes from the Jewish reggae star Matisyahu and his song Jerusalem. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from me tongue. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. In the ancient day, we will return with no delay, picking up the bounty and the spoils on our way. We've been traveling from state to state, and them don't understand what they say. 3,000 years with no place to be, and them want me to give up my milk and honey. Don't you see, it's not about the land or the sea, not the country, but the dwelling of His Majesty. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from me tongue. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from me tongue. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Rebuild the temple and the crown of
the preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.